Okay, thank you very much, Bianca, for giving me the opportunity to present our newest experimental results. Quite excited about that, so it would be great to get some feedback. So what that title is about, so it's the connection between, in this case, rotating black holes and fluid dynamics. I'm going to explain that a little bit more in details. And in particular, what we are interested is to understand the relevance of the black hole relaxation process in a simple bathtub vortex flow. Okay, so just a few slides. I think most of you know that already, but in case there's someone who doesn't, what all of this is about is based on the existence that there is a broad class of systems that can be optical systems, fluids of light, superfluids, normal fluids, electromagnetic waveguides, and so forth. And what these systems have in common is that small fluctuations within that system can be described by an effective relativistic classical and quantum field theory. Classical or quantum depends on what your system is. In our case, it's a fluid at room temperature. The quantum effects are absolutely negligible. So in our case, it's a simulator for a classical field theory in a flat or curved space-time geometry. And so why is that interesting is because there are the possibility now to mimic a variety of astrophysical systems, for example, rotating black holes, cosmological space-times, or also investigate interesting aspects of the quantum vacuum. I'm going to go back to that in a slide. So that area of research was invented by Bill Unruh in the 80s. And what is the nice part of that, or why it's very useful, you can now look at the experimental verification of all that processes that are predicted to occur within this various space-time scenarios. For example, like most prominently some black holes, there's a very nice studies recently by Jeff Steinhauer where he looks at Hawking radiation from a Bose-Einstein condensate. More recent effort on cosmological space-times, again by in Bose-Einstein condensates. This time it's a group in Maryland where also Ted Jacobson is involved. But there are many more processes you can investigate, for example, signature changes in space-time. And then very recently also I'm collaborating here with Matt Johnson on the Perimeter Institute, and also not collaborating, but other people working on that will be Ruth Gregory, who's here today, and Florent. And they're working on, can you, for example, mimic the false vacuum decay in a multi-component Bose-Einstein condensate? So all of this is very interesting, but it's not the topic of the talk. We're going to focus on what about the processes that occur around rotating black holes. And rotating black holes are quite an interesting physical system because of the many interesting processes that arise within. And for example, there's super radiance, which we've detected a few couple of years ago. And this talk is about light bending, analog of light bending, and the black hole ring down. Okay, so I already gave that away. So what is a black hole ring down, and why is it interesting to look at that in fluid flows? So I've stolen this picture here. It's a very famous from the first gravitational wave detection from LIGO. And what you're seeing here are two black holes depicted, which are in orbit, and they're getting closer and closer, and they start to merge. And when they have merged, that that newly formed black hole is not quite in its rest, not quite in its equilibrium. It has some bumps which has to shine off, and it does so by this famous quasi-normal mode, ring down modes, where it gives off this extra energy which it wants to get rid of. And so this is this last part here, which you see, which is referred to as a black hole ring down. Now, question is, there's this analogy here. Would I see this kind of behavior in a simple fluid flow? Now you could say, well, why do you care? We have seen this, we have observed that from a real black hole merger. So why would that be interesting? So the first thing is what you have to understand, of course, is what that ring down is a non-equilibrium process. It tells you of how it's an interesting aspect to study because it tells you how a black hole relaxes back into its equilibrium state. The same, of course, could apply to this fluid flows. And so studying the non-equilibrium behavior of fluid flows or superfluid flows is an interesting subject of research. So the next thing which is quite interesting is what the intention is, the long-term goal of what people want to do with these ring down modes. They're highly studied, and the reason is why they're so highly studied, because you can use that ring down to study how the gravitational wave experiences this gravitational potential that surrounds that newly formed rotating black hole. So it teaches you, if it's just vanilla GR, it teaches you about the black hole geometry, but more generally also tells you what kind of effective field theory you need to describe this ring down mode. So it lets you study simply some properties of this black hole. So in the same way, if I measure these characteristic modes in your fluid or superfluid, you can learn about that fluid flow. So can we use those ring down modes to probe this vortex flow? So can we use them as a fluid flow measurement tool? And it would be a very short talk if I would say no to both. And we were quite lucky. The answer to both of those questions is yes. These ring down modes are there. And as you will see, these vortex flows, they just scream out using this black hole relaxation process. They are naturally excited. And you can actually use them to detect the fluid flow velocities of the system. OK, so we have to say a few things about the system. And as already depicted, what we're looking at are surface waves. We're looking at the interface, air-water interface waves on a stationary draining bathtub vortex flow. Okay, so to connect that to black hole physics, we need to look at the light cones and the horizons in fluid flows. So let's just go back a step and see how black hole, or how these analog black holes have been discovered. What are the beginnings of analog gravity? So this goes back to a bit before 81, when Bill Andrew gave this lecture, gave a lecture in fluid dynamics, and he had the following idea. So he said, what if I look at small perturbations? In the first paper, he looked at sound waves in a fluid flow. And let's assume initially that fluid flow is at rest. And then if you have a small perturbation, a sound wave that propagates through that system, and then let's say you look at different times, always with a given certain same delta t, you look at how the sound waves propagate through the fluid flow. If the flow is at rest, as time goes on, the sound waves propagates equally fast in all directions. If the fluid flow is non-zero, a little perturbation initiated here propagates faster with the flow, which is in this case that direction, rather than against it. Now, suppose at the beginning, purely hypothetical, I could define an area in my fluid flow where the normal of the fluid flow projected onto this area is equal to the propagation speed of your sound waves everywhere. If you now would go and put a little perturbation on that area, sound wave could not propagate upstream anymore. It would get swept downstream. And that area here is referred to as an acoustic, in this case because it's sound waves, or an effective horizon in the system. So now, of course, this fluid flow could accelerate, could be what we call supersonic. And then, of course, you could decelerate it again. Meaning if I hear again the same thing, I have an area here where the fluid flow is equal to the perturbation speed of your sound waves in that system. But now what's happening here, I have subsonic reaching on this side, subsonic reaching on that. in between, sandwiched in between, is this supersonic region. If I now have a small perturbation on this side, I cannot send it upstream. I can propagate up to this point, but it cannot enter. So this is a time reversal of a black hole. It's an analog white hole horizon. So this is how you get these horizons. And then, of course, this is not all what Bill did. He went back to his office, as he told me, and he did a small calculation. And the calculation is he looked at the fluid's equation, which are starting with the Navier-Stokes, the continuity, and the equation of state. And then, of course, he made some assumptions, because otherwise these are quite difficult equations, even if you're at the linear level. But the assumption he made is he said, OK, let me assume it's irrotational, inviscid, and barotropic. And so in this case, the Navier-Stokes simplifies to the Euler equation, still have the continuity equation, and the equation of state is for a barotropic fluid, simply pressure perturbations equally density perturbations. So, and then furthermore, if the fluid flow is irrotational, then your background flow can be described with a single scalar field. So usually the background flow has three components, Vz, Vx, Vy, and Vz. But if you have an irrotational flow in three dimensions, you can simply define that as a gradient of a scalar field. And so what Bill then showed, he went on and showed, OK, he linearized that equation. There's a set of three coupled equations. And then what you can do, you can simplify it and can write it as a single equation for the perturbations in the velocity field. And this equation can be cast in the form of, in this case still, classical field theory in a curved spacetime geometry. Now, this curved spacetime geometry is, of course, an effective curved spacetime geometry. It's not astrophysical gravitational field. It is an effective curved spacetime geometry. And that's given by the c squared is, of course, not the light. It is the propagation speed of your perturbation here, the sound wave. And the v squared is the background flow. So the background flow and the perturbation speed that can depend on x and t, depending on what your setup is. And this gives you your emergent effective acoustic metric tensor. So this is not some bad magic. It's just a rewriting another way, simply another way of looking at that system. But having established this analogy or this connection, then you can look at all the effects which are predicted to occur around astrophysical spacetime geometries. So there is one caveat with the initial proposal, and that was that sound speeds, what you have to effectively have to do, you have to drive this fluid flow supersonic. Now, when you try to reach supersonic velocities, what happens is you create shock waves. Of course, there are ways around it, but it's not a trivial thing to do. So from a theoretical point of view, this is quite nice. From an experimental point of view, this becomes a bit difficult. So the way around was suggested, or an alternative to that, was suggested by Ralf Schützer and Bill Andrew, where they said, instead of looking at the sound waves in the fluid flow, these internal waves, pressure waves, internal pressure waves in the fluid flow, let us look at the interface waves. So that's, in general, like if you have an open system, so and you have on the free surface, your water is open, so you have a two-fluid system, it's an air-water system, and you can look at the perturbations that live on that interface. Those are referred to as gravity waves, because gravity as a restoring force plays a dominant role here. So what's important about this is that now here, as you can see in that metric, in this analog metric here, what goes in here, h, is the height of the fluid flow. So now we are in the shallow water approximation. So we have a water with a certain depth. And then we have here a two-dimensional velocity field, which I will talk later about that, which is on the free surface. And that's a radial and angular velocity. So, and this is, in a way, you're looking at your equations of motion and effective emergent field theory, which is valid on the free surface. And that, of course, is something that needs to be debated, and it's not that trivial. So what is the advantage here? it's not that obvious here, but this is, it's proportional c squared, and that's proportional to the height of the flow, and g is gravitational acceleration on Earth, so it's 10 meters per second squared. So for a 10 centimeter flow, you have about velocities of 1 meter per second. So in order to set up these analog horizons, you need to speed up the fluid flows in a meter a second, and that's certainly something we can do. Also, having said that, again, this is, there are some problems related to that. Now, these are these interface waves. Another thing which is really quite neat for surface waves is the following. So surface waves are the waves you can see on the beach, the shallow, when the beach comes up. And it's really when, on the beach, for example, the depths get smaller and smaller. And what's happening to these waves, they steepen and steepen and until they break. Why is that nice? Because one thing which is really problematic when you put something in a box, the boundary conditions of the box interfere with usually what you want to see. So by introducing beaches like that in an experimental setup, you have an open boundary condition. And of course, you have to choose your beach, the inclination of that slope smartly, which there are some restrictions of the experimental size. But what you can do, you can basically have very little reflection. So it's an open system. Okay, so kind of work on this for quite a long time now, why I'm so obsessed about this analog rotating black hole system. And that is because of, goes back to really what just astrophysical black holes, they have wonderful bizarre physics associated. So the question is, what is so cool about rotating black holes? Now, in general, and that's sort of really tied together, these two concepts of horizons and of light cones. So if we look at the light cones here, we have our right now, our future light cone, and our past light cone. So when you come close to an event horizon, what happens is that the notion of space and time gets interchanged. So suppose, forget about the things outside now, just focusing at the event horizon, and let's assume I have no rotation, otherwise I couldn't do what I'm doing now, and so I'm falling radially into the event horizon. Then what's happening when you come close to the event horizon, this notion of light cone, the light cones get tilted. So it messes up your space and time. So when you cross the horizon, space and time gets interchanged, and then what was your radial direction becomes your time coordinate, and now radially you have no other choice than falling radially, because your time is pointing to the center of the black hole, you have to fall into the singularity of the black hole. Now, there's an equivalent here in these fluid flows. It's not a light cone, it's a Mach cone. If it's sound waves, or if it's surface wave, it's called a Frau cone. So when indeed you have a fluid flow that fulfills the criteria of having these event horizons, and you take a little needle and you pinch the surface, you immediately see these cones arising. Now, that's just a black hole. Now, if that black hole is rotating, things become much more interesting. Instead of only having this event horizon, you get what's referred to as this ergosphere. Now, the difference between the two being in the language here of fluid dynamics becomes very easy to define those. The ergosphere is when the total velocity field, so that will be my radial and my angular component, is equal or larger than my propagation speed of my little ripples on the free surface. So, and the event horizon is where the radial component of the velocity field is equal to your ripple speed. Now, why is this neat? So once you have the ergosphere, so suppose you're coming or you take your little needle and you pinch that free surface. What you see is that already when you come into this ergosphere, that the light cones start to tilt, are the effective light cones. What it means in terms of someone falling into that region, you can go radially towards that region, but once you cross this region, your future light cone, the radial direction is not part of your future light cone anymore. What that means is you have no choice, but you experience what's referred to as frame dragging. You can still escape, but you have to co-rotate with the space-time fabric. So, this is this ergosphere, and precisely the same these spheres you can define with these simple notions of looking at the propagation speed of your ripples with respect to the background flow. Now, that's not all, and today there is something more here. which is topic of today's presentation, really. Besides all this interesting structure, there's something else around that. And that's referred to as the light rings, or these circular orbits. And as it will show, these are extremely robust in these fluid flows. They are just there, at least one part of them. The outer and inner light rings, the outer light rings are wonderfully there. And you can use them to explain and fully understand the black hole or the relaxation process in this fluid flow. Okay. So I was just preparing my talk and Googled, and someone made that picture of my lab by stitching together three different images, created this warped, clearly a curved space-time geometry lab. This usually is straight. Picture of my lab, which I don't know how they got their pictures, but I love the picture. I downloaded it and I'm using it now, and it's quite nice. What you see here in the center, that's the big setup, and you have to, this table here would close back here. So it's not that big, unfortunately, my lab, but you can see here, this is the experimental setup. So question is now, how do you set up a hydrodynamic rotating black hole? Well, as given away in the title, you have to build a gigantic bus tub. That's what we've did. So it's 3 meters long, it's straight, really. 3 meters long, 1 meter 50 wide, and half a meter high. And we have some, and I will explain in the next picture how exactly that works, but wonderful. So just to recapture, so question is how to set up a hydrodynamic rotating black hole.
Can I ask a very basic question? So superhelions, for example, thing that you're talking about, the book, has nothing to do with horizons and the existence of G Newton. That has nothing to do with gravity. It can appear in a variety of systems.
No, like going back, Seldovich cylinder.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the thing that I have a basic confusion about the sound of gravity is the following. So you set up a system describing known properties of gravity, let's say the horizon. So now, okay, so you're simulating something that you already know. What do you expect to learn from gravity?
It's a very good question. So what is the final goal?
And yeah,
we can exactly. Continue this also at the end, come back to that. But as a quick answer already is, so why do we need these simulators?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All you would get back in best case is try to squeeze the system into a situation where it's a nice analog to exactly the set of equations, and you're not testing anything about astrophysics, because the assumption is that we're not testing if these equations also hold for astrophysics. We just say if these equations hold for astrophysics and there's nothing that destroys, you know, nothing else that would dominate, if this is really the set of equations that covers that process, if I can tune a system such that it obeys the same equation, then of course, obviously, it should get back all these processes which you expect, right? It should work if you do it well, and if you're lucky.
If there is anything special to gravity beyond.
Sure, okay, let's assume that, you know, obviously, then it doesn't work. So what can we learn? So we're setting up the simulators. I think there are two steps. The first one is to show that it works, to validate this approach, to show that actually they are good simulators. Then you can think, can you drive the system now into a situation where analytics becomes difficult? Can we use it as true simulators, right? So, and this is sort of, is that step two, and can we get to that step two?
Yeah.
And should come back to this at the end of the talk, perhaps, and talk about this more longer. And then I will say there are, from a gravity perspective, I think there are, we can debate about this, there are some insights about this relaxation process, which is something I believe people are debating at the moment about black hole. And in black holes, real black holes, and this is something, what's the answer here to this question, which doesn't mean that applies to astrophysical
yeah.
black hole, but let's just perhaps, I haven't said anything new, right? And then we can say, what do we learn from this? What's the use for that, for fluid flows? And I will comment on that as well, right? It's not just gravity, it's also about the systems we're analyzing. Is it useful for this?
I'm not debating about
sure.
the systems, because you have very nice setups that you can control very well. But the question that I'm asking is about the direct connection between these simulators and actually learning something about gravity, which is not clear at all.
So what I'm going to do, I'm going to show what we've done, and I'm going to show you how we could drive this into a situation which might be more interesting to investigate.
Okay.
Remind me, just in case Diane forgot, remind me about this question. It is the question which we're facing, everyone working in there. It's the biggest critics, right? And I agree with you, that's something that needs to be discussed. The reason also I have to say, one of the things I have to be very clear, you cannot give this talk and not mention black holes, because that would be absolutely dishonest, because all the tools and everything I'm going to use now has been developed for black holes. So it's simply crediting the community and the people that have worked on. They need to get the credit. I'm using all black hole physics stuff. Okay. So how do you... Okay, so this was the setup and you saw the free surface. Let me just go back. So you see this free surface on the top. And now we say, okay, how do we set up this fluid flow? So this is one of the first technical drawings. And the idea was the following. This is a little model and paper I made when I was still a postdoc at CISA in Italy. And so the idea was, okay, if you go through the numbers and you think how big has that to be, then you realize, okay, it would be not very practical if you had to put this all on a rotating table. Because we're talking about 2,000 liters of water plus a steel frame and so forth. So it's very heavy, it's very big. So how, and you needed to be that big in order to see this effect. It was, so there's some thoughts going into why it has to be so big. Now, okay, we want to set up a rotating fluid flow. Now, the way we're doing it, instead of having it on a rotating table, you spin up the fluid flow, you give it this angular momentum by the way you feed in the water. So you have these inlet arms, and the way you give it in, it gives it, it pushes the bulk flow, the fluid flow in the center, and it gives it a rotation. And then, of course, here in the center, I want a stationary draining flow. I want a VR component, so I have a drain in the center. So how does it then look like? This is how this system looks like. In principle, we could completely put these acrylic divisions in there to exactly mimic this initial idea. At the end, we're not putting any of these things inside. It's like a Lego kit, really. So at the end, I'm just using this rectangular tank, and instead of putting these sides in, I'm creating open boundary condition with using bijus and having space for the wave generators, if we need it. For the black hole relaxation process, you don't need to stimulate the system. So then in the center here, you have these sinkholes. And again, it's very hard to really say, or from a theoretical point of view, even if you were to run the simulations, that's not an easy task to do, because if you have this interface, this air-water interfaces, bent surfaces, numerically, it's not so easy to exactly mimic that. So given that we don't know exactly what's the best setup, again, the idea would be instead of having one sinkhole, you have to have these exchangeable center plates. And this will be one, a funnel structure. We also have flat pieces and so forth. So it's like this Lego kit. And when you then put it together, you fill the water in. And then you also prepare it, because you need to, the observable in your system is that free surface. So you cannot just put tap water in there. You need to also put some fluorescent dye into it, which we're using for imaging purposes. So this is the whole system running. This is one example for this vortex forming in our setup. What we did for the super radiant experiment in the first part, the light bending in this system, we used this sensor which we developed with a company called EnShape from Germany. We have a pending patent application on it, as I always say. We'd be happy to sell one of those. So if you're interested, please do talk to me. And the way it works, you have this a blue pattern that is 500 times per second. You project a random pattern onto the free surface. You have two cameras, like two eyes, stereo imaging. You record this free surface. And from that information, you reconstruct the free surface. You get point clouds back. And you get...
Can you explain? So this is, there is a dye. So the dye is like tracers of the flow.
No, I put a fluorescent dye in there that dissolves in there.
Yeah.
So then the fluid is green. Then I come from the top, and what this dye does, it takes the blue part of the light,
yeah,
and blue part and converts it into green. So what we do, we project the blue light onto it. It gets converted into green. I have two cameras sitting here, and I have filters that cut out the blue part and only let the green part through. This way, you get rid of all direct reflection. So that's very important, because if you have a surface like that, you have a lot of direct reflection that makes, and that would mean you have all the blind spots. And this is exactly around the horizon.
Okay.
So we're using this to get rid of all the unwanted effects. And also because water would be transparent, you need to put something in there so that you can actually just see the free surface. And then what's nice about this sensor is that there's a live reconstruction of the free surface. Okay, now.
It's okay, but it's not too stupid a question. How are you seeing these surface waves if it isn't biofilm?
Good. So if you were to have a pattern, let's do it in a different way. So suppose you project a stripy pattern onto a flat surface.
Yeah.
And suppose now there would be a little bump in the surface. The stripes would change.
Yeah.
That's the way we see it. Okay, so, and it wasn't a stupid question. That was a good question. I haven't explained that at all. Because you know what pattern you project, right? Because you project a pattern, you take two images of it, because they're distorted, that's how you...
So that's how...
And it's correlation measures as well. So it's a bit, but the basic idea is that the pattern gets deformed.
What accuracy, I guess you're saying there, what accuracy does it give you in flow and...
We have two different methods. So for the first part, for this you're sort of in the 10 micrometer, the amplitudes you resolve. And the spatial resolution is every 2 millimeter you have a point, an X and Y. And the surface is 1.50 m by 1.10 m. And with the other one, which is, the other advantages is a more commonly developed method, this fast checkerboard demolition method, where we have a pattern below. We can get higher resolution, but we would have problems if the surface itself, I want to have little ripples on a surface. If the surface itself bends a lot, then there can be some problems. If that up, because a delta H along your surface is changing too much, that can cause this problem. And with our stereo imaging, that is not a problem. So you can really look into the vortex. Two things. So this is the setup, more or less. But for the black hole relaxation process, we're doing an experiment where you probably think, maybe afterwards Bianca was saying, maybe I could do this in my bus stop. And I would say, probably. What are we going to do? So usually what we did is we set up these analog space-time geometries, and we're working in this classical system, purely classical system. So what we did is we made it easy for us. We sent in coherent waves. Now, there are also experiments that wouldn't use coherent waves. For example, Florent did an experiment on looking at Hawking radiation, and instead of working with coherent waves, he worked with the noise in the system, the mechanical noise in the system, which would basically have little ripples, noise on the free surface. You could also work with thermal noise if you can reduce the mechanical noise, which is vital in these big systems. Okay, so. What we're doing instead, we are setting up an Andrew vortex. Now, if you don't know what an Andrew vortex is, that is not a problem because we're sort of defining the Andrew vortex now. And so the goal was to set up an Andrew vortex flow, and that was to investigate the black hole relaxation process. We set up a vortex flow out of equilibrium. So that goes back to, so how can you make this analog emitting, you know, quasi-normal mode. So one thing Louis suggested to me ages ago, 10 years ago, I don't know, long time ago, we're getting too old, he said, could you not just have two vortices that merge, right? Like a real black hole merger. So, well, if you work with black holes, that's what you have to work for. If you have, of course, if you had a real grip on your black hole, you wouldn't need to do something so fancy. You could just push it. You could push it out of equilibrium. And that's what we're doing. We're pushing it out of its comfortable position. And so, and what we say, we call such a restless vortex an Andrew vortex flow. And that's because in German, the word Unruhe means restless. And of course, Andrew is also the name of the guy who invented the whole field. So we thought that's quite nice. So how do you set up an Andrew vortex flow? And that's not very difficult. So we put in water, it's pumped continuously from one corner at the flow. We don't even use both inlet arms for practical purposes. We don't do anything. What we usually do, we don't straighten, have flow straighteners. We make it really messy because we want to get out of equilibrium. So from one corner at the flow, we have a fixed flow rate, 15 liters per minute, just in case you're interested. So the sinkhole, we cover the sinkhole with a plug. And we do this, we fill the water up to 10 centimeters, which is above of where the height would be for a stationary fluid flow. Then we pull the plug, we go step back, and we wait for the water to go down to about 5.55 centimeters, which means you, because we know from experience in watching that system that you get close to the point where it would be in a stationary state. And then it's in this quasi-stationary and quasi-equilibrium. That's exactly in the black hole merger when you get the nice ring down is after, not immediately after they have merged, but after some time, you are in this phase. And that's what we're doing. So, and then what we're using here, because here now we are not working with monochromatic waves. So we needed a better resolution than we had with our sensor. And this time, we want to look in deep in the vortex, but we couldn't. And we had a small region because all we were interested here now is the time oscillation of the free surface. So we needed something very accurate with a very high frequency. And so we used a different method, and we are now having a pattern underneath the water on the bottom of the tank, and we take images of this pattern and how it looks like if the little ripples deform that pattern, and we then take 800 frames per second to have a high resolution. Okay, so that's a setup. That's all good. Now, but we need to know what we're looking for. We need to have a theoretical model. And that's always been something which is very hard in these analogs, because unfortunately the wave equation is not just this vanilla classical or quantum field thing curved space time. You have dissipation in a system and it is a mess. It is really a mess. And the question is, do you really have an effective field theory that's valid on that free surface everywhere? And surely something in the center is happening, the flow becomes rotational, and it would be silly just to say that's all that's going on. However, turns out that for the outer light ring modes, you can have such a theoretical model that exactly describes what that system is doing. Now we have to do a big detour because, okay, now you could, how you calculate that when boundaries are an issue. That's something people have discussed about. I'm going to talk what quasi-normal modes are, but one of the problems is like instead of directly calculating the quasi-normal modes, there is a problem. Because quasi-normal modes are being calculated that you say, well, I have a black hole, I have purely ingoing boundary condition at the horizon, and I have purely outgoing boundary condition at infinity. Now, problem is if you put a black hole in a box, and if you don't really have control exactly what's going on in the vortex flow, you don't know if you have full absorption in the center, really. And certainly what you have on all the sites where I don't have a beach for, which I cannot place because of time spatial constraints, I have purely reflecting boundary condition. So does it make sense to talk about quasi-normal modes? And the clear answer would be no. But these quasi-normal modes have two components. They have a real, an oscillatory part, and they have a decaying part. The decaying part surely depends on the boundary condition and how you initiate that signal. The oscillatory part, that's something which was conjectured, shouldn't depend on that. And you can calculate that in a different way. And that different way is referred to as light rings, and that different way, for that you need to do this detour, and instead of directly going at looking at the wave equation and calculate the modes that have these particular boundary conditions, you can look at geodesics. Now again, we can not only look at geodesics because my system is not, the fluctuations are not fully described by just the effective metric because we have extra terms in that wave equation. So therefore, you shouldn't call it geodesics, you should call it characteristics. And that's what we're doing. We're calculating the path on this emergent analog space-time geometry, also taking all the Lorentz violations, which they are, into account. Okay, and this is something I started earlier on. That was with my PhD student, Theo Torres. Back then, Anton Akrotar was a postdoc in my group. Sam Dolan, external collaborators in University of Sheffield. and myself. So what was this idea? Is in fact, it is an extension of an earlier paper from Sam Dolan, who suggested PLUS to look into that. So what we wanted to understand is something that goes back to a previous experiment we did, which is to look at super radiance in that system. And what we did there, this is where we recorded these pictures. What this is a time. It is we record the free surface over time. And then what we do, we use a Fourier transform in time. You can use Hilbert transform. You could also use wavelet or windowing functions. So that's what we're doing. We can also compare the things. There's effectively no difference. And what we do is then once you've filtered, you can then filter for the wave you're sending in, which is this monochromatic wave, and you remove the background and all the noise. That's what you see. So you see how this wave front evolves when it interacts with this vortex flow. And so you have these different pictures here are from different frequencies of that monochromatic wave. That's all it is. And the question is, why do we get these funny pictures? How can we understand the reason why a waveform behaves in such a strange way? And that simply is because that perturbation is propagating on a curved space-time geometry. It will bend. So that's why. But can we actually verify that hypothesis? So this, I just should say, where you can find how we recorded this image. This is in this previous paper where we investigate super radiance. Now, the assumption we are making is we have a two-dimensional velocity field. These gray lines is depicted here. So these are the streamlines of the field. And you have a radial and an angular component. And how we did this experiment, we had like waves created on one end, plane wave fronts, which we're sending into this vortex. And on the other hand, we create this open boundary condition so that it's not a box. It's that basically you don't have reflection back, which could become a problem. This is how it looks like, just also because I kind of liked that video. It's not really necessary, but it's nice to see. This wave is coming, interacting with this vortex flow, and then these funny things are going on. To understand how dramatic an analog spacetime that is for a plane wave, we did this very basic simulation where we use this geodesics, where we use the tools and techniques used to calculate the characteristics in that system. So what you're going to see is you have this wave front. So that line represents a wave front of this plane wave. And now we see how that wave front moves through the image. And what you can see, it gets bent so much that the wave fronts on the upper and the lower side, they interact with itself. And try it again. And so what that already explains, I go back. You see these things here, these interferences, can now be already understood because it's the two these two wave fronts merging over there. So this is in the time domain, we can run the wave equation, but there we cannot take dissipation into account. We can solve the wave equation. Sam Patrick, another PhD student of mine, did that. Previous one was by Theo Torres. And then you can see how, when you start sending these wave fronts, how this pattern forms. Now that's good. Now we need a theory to calculate these characteristics. So as I said before, this effective field theory is kind of is not as simple as I said. And when I had this slide with this analog metric there and this wave equation, that's pretty much a lie. That's not how it is. It's nice to think about it. What you get indeed a simplification, which is not valid close to the core, is that field theory. And what you have, this phi is your perturbation and velocity field. Remember I said the background flow is the gradient of a velocity of a scalar field, and the perturbation in that scalar field that obeys this equation.
Sorry, Silke, is that an ansatz to describe this, or does that actually come?
It's derived.
It is derived.
I mean, it is with many approximations.
Yeah, but so mathematically, you know, I see kind of mixing of second and third order derivatives.
Yeah, it's a mess.
And that could give rise to true mathematical instabilities. Have nothing to do with.
It is always second order in time. It is always second order in time. It has dissipation in there. It is, of course, if you take...
Is that dissipation? I don't necessarily see that.
This is from the viscosity here. That's a viscosity term.
Yeah, but it's
it has one dt, yeah, a single time. It gives you an I omega. It gives you an I omega, Luis. So it's imaginary.
Right.
This is a dt. This is a two time derivatives. That's one. So it gives you an I omega. It gives you an imaginary frequency. It gives you an I omega. And here, what you have here, of course.
If I do a Fourier expansion in space, I would have an I squared k squared, and then the I omega. Now, I would have I cubed. So I'm not sure if that's the right sum. We can take a look at this.
Okay. Should we discuss it later? I'm not quite sure what you. Okay. Anyway. So. What you have is, to be honest, forget about that whiskers term, the term which you said due to the viscosity. If you look at that, and I would expand this ton h, you get an infinite tower of this derivative. So it is something. It is, if the closest I could think to in gravity is Horava-Lipschitz gravity, not taking into account that Nabla to the 3, because it also would violate parity. So is a complicated effective field theory. So this thing here, this gamma, is the surface tension, that part. For shallow water waves, this simplifies, and all you get back is also second order spatial derivative, up to second order spatial derivatives, and that guy, if of course neglecting that there is viscosity. Now, you can generally write that as some functions of this of the gradient here, so you can write it as general functions. You don't need to focus on a particular case. You can extend that to a general class, and you can calculate the characteristics. Now, in the absence of a background flow, these solutions are just the plane waves, meaning you can now do a Fourier transform in space and time, because it's inhomogeneous and time independent. So then what you get back is simply the dispersion relation of gravity waves. This is how they look like. Now, what we are then using are the standard tools, extended, of course, to account for this more complicated dynamical equation for the perturbations. And then so what you're using is this ray tracing methods. So this WKB, where you say, well, I'm approximating that my solutions have rapidly oscillating phase and a slowly varying amplitude. And then you can derive these Hamilton-Jacobi equations, and you get the set of Hamilton equations which you have to solve, and you also have to fulfill the Hamilton constraint. And this is how then you can make a prediction and calculate the characteristics. And so what we're doing here is, suppose you have here a plane wave front, and I look at different points on that plane wave, and with a certain impact parameters, I'm launching that point, and I see how it has to find its way through this analog space-time geometry. And what you're seeing here, these are it's something which is very clear, but it's very trivial. So you have a wave coming this way. That point here would be radially. These ones are the co-rotating in this case, so the vortex goes that way. These are the counter-rotating. So, and then you can ask yourself, so which points of that can escape to infinity and which are getting absorbed? The solid red lines are the co-rotating ones that can escape to infinity. The dashed blue ones are the counter-rotating that can go to escape to infinity. These here are the ones, the rays that have to fall inside. Then you have an outer light ring and an inner light ring. So this is for the counter-rotating waves, a circular orbit. And this is for the co-rotating one. Now, the co-rotating is very close inside. And in fact, in our case, if you calculate its position, it would be outside the fluid flow. So we do not expect anything to come from this one. But that thing is where the effective field theory using this outer light ring should be valid. So this should be a robust concept. Now, from this, you can also, along that trajectory, you can see how the face evolves. And then by only plotting where the same values of the faces are, you can map out these wave fronts, and this is how they would look like. And then you can say, OK, that's nice. Let's then compare that to the experimental data. And then you simply overlap the theoretical predictions. Not very accurate, right? It's not like using nonlinear regression and a really solid method. But in this case, we also don't expect it to be a perfect match, which I explain in 1 second. But let me just first say the background here is the experimental data, and these are the wavefronts laid on top. And it is quite a good approximation until you come too close. And the problem is that this is an approximation. And even if you go to next order and include the transport equation, you still know that this is not the whole story. You need non-adiabatic changes because the fluid flow is so fast. So hence, you don't expect that to be perfect. And that's what we're also seeing. The wave comes in. It's quite a good description. But whatever, when it interacts here inside with this vertex flow, then clearly, the scheme we're using is not perfect. But it's not a bad way. And this is sort of the analog of this light bending in this system. Now, and this is something I think, and please do always correct me, I get most of my feedback from my husband, who works on real black holes, and we are sometimes discussing this a bit. And so one of the things is, okay, you can, instead of directly calculating the ring down modes, you can use these light rings. This is a fact. You can use the light rings to estimate both the real and imaginary part of this ring down mode. Now, one of the things, of course, which is known, that the imaginary part would change depending on the boundary conditions. So the ring down depends on the boundary conditions in the system. But the real part should be a very robust feature, and it should be able that you estimate this with the outer light ring. So if you have this, so in this system, so what we're using in order, the problem is why we are not also, besides the boundary conditions, also that the wave equation is sufficiently difficult that it's hard to directly solve it. So instead, we're using this light ring method, and so what you can use here for looking for these light rings is you're looking for the circular orbits or equilibrium points in the Hamiltonian. So they have to fulfill these three conditions. So there are critical points in the Hamiltonian for R and KR, the wave number in the radial component. So, right. And what that gives you is it gives you a prediction, a frequency depending only on M. And I'm going to, M is the Ansi-Moodle number, and I'm going to explain that in a second. So that means is that's a weird sort of dispersion relation that doesn't depend on the radius. So it's flat. So if you're looking something that is not dependent on the radian. So what's an Ansi-Moodle number? And it's just, suppose you have, usually, of course, you think of plane waves, but plane waves, you can decompose it into Ansi-Moodle parts. And that would mean that, okay, you say, you want to know you have a radial direction, and it can go around this way or that way. Now, because if something is going around this way, it has to have periodic boundary condition. Right? It's a wave going around that way. It has to match up with itself. So it has to be periodic. So if it's co-rotating, so it would be positive Ansi-Moodle number, but the first thing you can fit is one wavelength. So that's m equal 1. And the second one, we can fit exactly two wavelengths. That would be m equal 2. And if it's counter-rotating, just give it a minus. OK. And then you can calculate this quasi-normal modes. And the real part is really related to this circular orbits. And the imaginary part can also be estimated. But that's not relevant for now. Oh, yeah, OK. So this is on top. That shouldn't be like this. But what you see here, this is a simulation, again, of how you can excite in the linear level, these quasi-normal modes, how would they look like? And what we're doing here, this is a simulation in the time domain. And you send a few waves, and then you stop. And then this is how it looks. Ah, that's good. Yes. Then I can take this out. So you see, we stop the waves. And then what you see have this spiral wave left. And that's how a quasi-normal, a nice ring-down mode, and this is where the boundary conditions are all like exactly as you expect, how this ring-down mode would look like. Okay. So coming back to now, that tells us how to extract the frequencies using this method, the light ring method. And now let's see if this is what we get in our setup. So what we are having here is this is what the free surface would look like if you set up that vortex.
Well, before was for what system? For a black hole or
an analog system?
So the vortex. So you take the vortex that you showed before.
Wow. Okay. Sorry, I haven't said it. So this simulation in the time domain.
Yes.
And taking the simple analog metric, as you know, Bill established it, without all these complications of the higher spatial derivatives and dissipation, just a wave equation up to second order time and second order spatial derivatives, and I put in a velocity field that's 1/r in the angular and in the radial component. The simplest thing you can do. So you have horizon and I have open boundary conditions at infinity.
Okay.
Right, it's where you don't expect anything different. Okay, so this is what you get. So when you look at this unruh vortex and you stand in front of it and we repeated it 25 times, so you spend a lot of time waiting for that, going into this quasi-equilibrium state, and you look at the surface, it constantly gives things off. And if you were to take an image of that, you record that, and then you get rid of the background, this is what it would look like. This is everything. It's basically minus the background, all the noise on the system. Looks like a bit of a mess. I should mention that all of these results can be found online with the title which I sent for this talk. And the work has been done with Theo Torres, Sam Patrick, Maurizio Ricards, and myself. These are my collaborators. So these are my two students, and that's my long-term external collaborator.
So how do you define your noise here?
It's not, I mean, I don't send anything, okay? I mean, in fact, it is not only noise. There's something in there. What I'm saying with this, suppose you have, I set up this vortex flow. I'm setting up that system. First, it's plugged. It's just water in this basin. Mm-hmm. I pull the plug, and it starts draining. And then I start till this, you know, so it gets in a quasi-equilibrium, so the water height at infinity does not change, and at the boundary does not change much. And then what you see on the surface, you see little ripples.
Sorry, but what you mean that doesn't change, mean it doesn't move, there's no velocity there?
No, the fluid flow I'm still feeding.
At the boundary.
Well, at the boundary of the non-slip boundary condition. I mean, on the inlet it's not, but you always have the non-slip boundary condition on solid boundaries. The velocity has to go to zero. So the velocity field is going like 1/r. It is rotational, but every velocity field outside the core is really 1/r, and it rapidly goes to zero. So, and this is how this free surface looks like. It gives you an estimate. This is in millimeter. In millimeter. Wonderful. So this is how these perturbations look like. These are tiny perturbations on the free surface, and sometimes you do see them by naked eye. So then what we do, we have to, again, remember we want to see a frequency as a function of m. So you need to do a decomposition. And to do this, you can use wavelet transform, Hilbert transform. We compare the two, it gives the same result. And the reason why they're giving the same result, maybe some of you who are more familiar with that might wonder, why is that? The reason is they're constantly being created, not just spike. It's not like one black hole merger. There's still, we can debate about why that is, but these modes are in the system and they're keep on being created. And now, in a second, there will be what I think we learned from this. And maybe you knew that already, but we're getting to this. So this is what you get. We decompose. This is the power spectral density of the height field. And we decompose this. These are the counter-rotating part, fluctuations, and these are the core-rotating. And then we do this for M's, we can do it for M up to 50, but there's, why can we see so many M's? Well, the thing is you have your analog black hole or your vortex flow. How many analog gravitational wave detected do you have? Well, every point on my free surface, every pixel is a detector because I can see how it oscillates, but I know I also have the information, the spatial information resolution. And we have 2,000 by 1,000, 2,500 by 1,800 pixels. So we have many, many points on that free surface, and I can see how these fluctuations are at their phase relation. And so this is why we can see very high M. And it turns out because we can see nicely up to M25, but they're excited up to M50. So 50 Ansi-Mudel numbers. Now, that's what we see. Sorry. That's what we see, the noise. And so now this is what we get. And there I will zoom into one of those. These are the counter-rotating ones, and these are co-rotating ones. What we were looking for is a frequency that does not depend on R. So what are we plotting here? This is a power spectral density, and this is a radius. So we want something that's flat. So this is already excluded, and I'm going to say what that is. So, and we're plotting, so this green signs, this is the data, that's the noise in the system, the ambient noise in the system, and that noise that can be decomposed onto M equal minus 5 and plus 5. And so then the red line is the minimum energy curve in the system. The minimum energy curve, what does this mean? That I need to explain now. We're getting close to the end, I hope. It's okay. Bianca, do we have time? 5 minutes? Okay. Okay, so we have this plot here, where I have this power spectral density over R. And then I have this red line. That red line is a minimum energy a mode needs to have to propagate up to some point. So suppose you have a perturbation with a certain frequency. This one could propagate up to here. Inside here, because it has to overcome the angular momentum barrier. This is not just the angular momentum barrier, it has all the dispersion and all these effects in there included. It's not just the gravitational potential, it's all of it. But you can ask yourself, something comes, can it actually reach the vortex center? And the answer is, this one doesn't have enough energy. Because here, it gets back reflected. Here inside, it would be an evanescent mode. There is a part of it that can leak in, but that will die out. It has to go back. It cannot go through. The first mode that can go through is this one. And that first mode is the first channel that opens and allows a mode to transfer. That is the channel, the first channel to use for an M mode of that kind, M equal 5, to exchange energy or transfer energy from the core to the outside. And what we show also mathematically can be shown, and that's going to the next one. So now, before I do this, let me. So this means this red line defines a threshold between above that line up to some radius, or if you take really what is where the maximum of these lines is, after above the frequencies above there, they would be propagating modes everywhere. Below that, there are regions where it can only evanesce. It doesn't have enough energy to reach the center or get out of the center. So this line divides into propagating evanescent. And so since I'm running out of time, we don't see this flat behavior here because it's also not unexpected. There are several things that why we don't expect to see the inner light ring modes, and that is because this, the angular momentum barrier, or this curve for the inner ones is really high. So, and then also it would actually, the inner light ring, this thing would be outside the fluid flow. So this makes no sense. But also at that high frequencies, right, it would anyway dissipate away. And another thing is what we believe, what should be there instead, or hope, is that there would be these quasi-bound states, which we predict to get if you include the vorticity in the vortex core. I have one slide at the end to just point this out. So there might be some other physics lying there. So this is this red line. Now you could say, wait a second, didn't you just say that anything below that red line cannot propagate? That is true. What these orange things I took us was a real headache. When we have the water inlet, you create little vortices, potential vorticity. In irrotational flows, they survive. These little dimples in the free surface, they propagate into the core, and they modify the surface, and they get dragged with the velocity of the fluid flow. And what we're plotting here is exactly the velocity of the fluid flow, and you can see this shows you they exist or how their path through this flow is, this little potential vorticity that drains. Now coming back to this, and I think this is something interesting, might be interesting for black hole physics, might not be, I'm not an expert, but here's what we have in this system, and that's really interesting. So what we show is that there's a new interpretation for the light ring condition. And what is that? The critical points of a Hamiltonian, you know, dh by dr and dh by dkr, and the Hamiltonian constraint, h equals zero, this is how we found this critical, or these circular orbits, that you can also rewrite that, and they are critical points of the dispersion relation, which means it's exactly where this, where the omega, dr equals zero, that's where the light ring position is. Now, clearly, since this is the only way, the first way, for that vortex to give off energy to the outside, that's the channel it has to use. And this is not, that's another way of looking at the light ring. Not by looking at geometry or all these things, it's simply the first energy channel that opens up and that allows to get, for the system to get back in equilibrium. So then what can I get 5 more minutes? Because that's a really... Is it? Okay. This is really important. So first I need to convince you, okay, how do we pick then this frequency mode? Now, we're not doing it for all, we're doing it for -5, -10 within steps of 5. So, and then this here, can we see how this would look like? That this is these clear peaks. So we identify, we get this by, we have 25 repetitions, we get these peaks. Now, there are now 2 ways to go forward. The first thing is we need to validate that these are really the light ring modes. And we have to, in order to do that, we say, okay, we have the wave equation, this complicated wave equation. We need, what we do not have is the velocity field. So the first thing we need to do is we can say, let me measure independently the velocity field. We do this by using the standard technique, which is very expensive, and I'm making this now very dramatic. It's a very hard method because what you will see later on, this light ring mode is an alternative way to measure the fluid flows. So, but the standard way would be you put little particles. We are using pyrolite. We grind them down by hand. We have sieves. We get them in the micro. Ours are about 200 micrometers in diameter. And then we put them in the fluid flow, and then we have a laser light sheet, and then we have a fast camera again to take the images, and then 800 frames per second. And then from one image to another, you first identify a small area with this particle inside. You look at the next image, and you see how that has been shifted. And then you refine the window up to that you have a small cell where there are at least 5 particles inside. And so from this, you can reconstruct the fluid flow. Now, in the area we're looking, the radial velocity is almost zero. And this needs to be debated, but I don't have so much time, but you have to trust me that it's very small, and it's going to be playing a role later. Now, this is the velocity field we're getting, and this will be a 1/r match. So from here, we're extracting the fluid flow, basically the parameter which we then put in our wave equation, and then what we can do is we can make, see if the data agrees with the experiment. And so what you do is, so this... the data is the green dots, and the error bar is using standard techniques for the confidence intervals. And then what we see here is that you have your data, and the red dashed line is a PIV method. So if I were to make use my effective field theory, put the velocity fields in as I got them, then I can make a prediction for the frequency, the real part of the frequencies of this light ring mode, and then what you would see is that you get a very good agreement up to -25.
So why is it that you have larger errors, relatively speaking, for the OSCmittal number? Let me just see.
No, I know the answer. I'm just, it is also. Can I come back to it in the end because I'm running short? We know why that is, but give me a second. Give me a second because Bianca will give Mary, will cut me off. So, okay, so having done this means that method works. Now you can ask a different question. Suppose I would not have I don't have the money to afford doing PIV methods, to buy the lasers, to have this camera. or, you know, what if I cannot do this? Then could I use that information now to extract a velocity field from that characteristic mode? So instead of I take the data, and we're using our theoretical model, we use non-linear regression, and then we say what is the best fit, and that would be the black line. Okay, and that black line is associated to some velocity. So what you have to do is, so how it turns out, this here I have, and I should write that down for 1 second, just to be very clear. So the velocity field has a circular component in the angular direction, and a draining component, negative sign, in the radial component. So it's the parameters C and D, circulation and drain. And then what you get with this, if you use our, using these techniques applied from black hole physics applied to the system, what you get is a fit, there's not a single point that fits, is a whole curve that gives you this black line, which is the best match. So this is my parameter space that you get from the outer light ring. If you also have the inner light ring, this would go, the curves would go like that, and the intersection would be the point. Now what's happening, so since we don't have an inner light ring, we cannot fully constrain it, but what we know from the PIV measurement is that the radial velocity is very small. It's basically zero. So the PIV measure cannot even get the radial velocity, so it gives you this regime here, the error bar. And what we are doing here, we're using the bootstrap method, and with a 95% confidence interval, we can see, you know, that means within 95%, what we see lies in this region. This gives you what the velocity field from the parameter C you would get from using the characteristic modes. And they overlap. Now, of course, it seems that this error interval is smaller, but of course you could also improve the PIV method. So it's just that it's definitely a comparable method. I have to stop. Just one thing, what about this inner light ring? It's not just falling off the edge. What we recently shown with Sam Patrick, Antonin Quentin, and Maurizio Ricards and myself, what we've shown is that if you take the rotational vortex core into account, the effective field theory you get is that it looks like a field theory that locally acquires a mass. By interacting, so this is what the equation would be, and if you solve for that system, you also get quasi-bound states. Now, this is sort of the characteristic modes we're getting. This would be your standard ring-down modes. Quasi-bound states would be hovering there in this region here in the potential. They would be hovering around. We have not seen this, but there's experimentally, we were not able to even look at that regime. That's about it. Just want to say that that's an old summary that shouldn't be there because I didn't talk at all about super radiance. What is interesting, so what can we do with this? So first of all, I think it is nice to see how this work, that why is it so nice to have these tools from black hole physics to analyze these vortex flows? Now, of course, whenever you have a system in a box, you can look for its eigenmodes, its characteristic modes, right? If you were to hit the box and with fluid in it, you would excite the characteristic modes of this box. Now, of course, this depends on the boundary conditions. The light ring modes are local concepts, right? They're critical points of the dispersion relation. And so what it means is that independent of your experimental setup or where you have your fluid flow inside, you can still calculate these things and make a prediction which seems to work extremely well. And so in terms of a non-equilibrium process for these vortex flows, they really do play an important role. And then, of course, what we're doing currently, can we apply our findings to superfluid flows? So what we're doing, we're simulating pure superfluids, Bose-Einstein condensates, in a particular setup, and see if we still get these quasi-normal nodes in there. Now, why would that be interesting? Now, the interest here is very, very simple. This is wave-current interaction in a superfluid system, which is simply not understood, right? And you could test if that's captured, that behavior with your effective field theory. And I haven't gone back to Mina's question, but one thing you can ask now. Now, look, what happens if you drive your system into a regime which we do not quite understand how it works, where the theory becomes a bit messy? For example, if you have non-separable wave equation. Right, and can you then still find to understand an understanding by looking at what you get of how this system behaves? Perhaps.
Are you referring to for the fluid?
For the fluid system.
For the fluid is clear, like in the superfluid, I can imagine there is an analogy, but for gravity, there is no reason.
So, and for gravity, what I'm saying is, we cannot fight about this because I agree with you. Okay, so I cannot put up a fight for something I don't say. You're right. But what I can say is perhaps as a feedback mechanism, right, is there something what we learn here that could give some ideas for someone working on black hole physics, a new idea, a new insight of how to attack the problem? So that's the best we can do at that point.
Another thing is you're not God with the black hole system, whereas Silke is God in the lab, right? So she can control the system she's got. And if you want to test particular aspects, then...
I'm not arguing about that. It's a great, the experiment is fantastic. There's no question about it. The question is, I'm just asking the general, but she agrees.
To what extent does it program?
Yeah, exactly. That's a basic, for example, and you know very well, Sporelius, as you say it there, it's a universal phenomenon that has nothing to do with black holes and the existence of the Ergo region or the horizon itself.
Okay, let me also be a bit more positive. So where could this field be in 10 years, right? And so I'm saying is we're still at the point where we need to validate our methods. In the future, what can we do? We can look at the force vacuum decay, if we can get that going. Can we have multiple bubbles colliding? And can we look at that simulations in situations which we cannot calculate, right? Can we look at situations in cosmology we don't understand? For example, signature changes. You can drive signature changes in this analog space-time geometry. Can you look how the modes evolve in such a system, and can you get some ideas of feedback how this, you know, could inspire some models for cosmology? So this is at the moment the best I can say. I think what it also does, and I think this is really, really important to me, is it trains a generation of, you know, young researchers that have a very clear connection to reality. They have a different training, and I think there's a big effort in looking at tabletop experiments to make really cosmological constraints, right? And to really there's an effort really to combine fields to precision measurements. I think that this kind of training, this kind of expertise, which people are going through, that could be very vulnerable. Maybe one of my students one day will really make a big discovery. So in that, I really want to stop. It's the best I can say about my research.